Welcome to HIT Health Issues Today. You're listening to WRFG in Atlanta on 89.3 FM. This is Dr. Asha Bhumkar presenting today's program. This program may contain some adult issues, so listener discretion is advised, and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent opinions voiced by WRFG, its volunteers, or anybody else. We have Dr. Sonali Saha here in the studio with me. Welcome to HIT, Dr. Saha.
Thank you for having me back.
Can you tell us something about yourself?
I am an addictionologist. So I'm an internal medicine doctor that studied addiction as well as young adult and adolescent medicine. I did two fellowships. Mm-hmm. And in doing so now, I work with addicts of all ages. I see patients at Ridgeview, and I also have a private practice on that campus. And I also teach students at Morehouse and Emory Schools of Medicine about addiction medicine. Addiction.
So what do you see, in addiction in Atlanta?
Well, unfortunately, Atlanta, like many American cities, is being very hard hit by the opiate epidemic, and in particular, heroin. And here in Atlanta, because of the history of Atlanta, really was constructed as a city that was about transportation and being a hub for trucks, for trains, for planes, and that was intentional. And one of the unfortunate side effects of that is that Atlanta is now a distribution hub for heroin in the South. And so one of the terrifying things about what I see on a day-to-day basis is our youngest generation, you know, the young adult population, ages 18 to 25, now using, you know, IV heroin, which is something that's very specific to this generation in this particular moment of history.
I'm surprised they can find a vein.
Well, it's interesting, you know, the way in which drug culture and drug commodities kind of have shifted as a result of this epidemic. You know, it used to be that drugs were centrally located in the urban areas and usually were those people who were indigent minority coming home from war. Those were people who were the most at risk for substance use, and people would kind of go to those pockets in urban areas to get their drugs. Now the landscape has changed, and delivery guys and Facebook and texting, all of that has allowed for a new culture where the drug dealer comes to your house in Alpharetta or Marietta. And it's really that triangle of suburbs kind of just north of Atlanta that really gets has been the hardest hit by the opiate epidemic.
So really we don't know who is doing what.
Well, we do have a sense that it is the young, affluent, suburban male and female, which is very different also in terms of its nature. Usually being female, it used to be protective against substance use. In those communities, places like Alpharetta, Marietta, just north of the city. When you say we don't know who's doing it, I think you may be alluding to, you know, people that you would never expect to be doing it are doing it.
That's what I meant. Mm-hmm. Your neighbor might be doing it, your friend might be doing it, you know, things like that.
It's very commonplace. I think we used to, because of just the nature of how, you know, marginalized heroin use has been historically and how desperate people have been when they find themselves addicted to heroin, it's really been something that we've seen on the fringe of society. When I went to high school, you know, nobody was using opiates. Something like less than 1% of United States high schoolers had ever tried an opiate. And now because of prescription drugs, which is where 80% of people who are currently addicted to things like heroin, you know, are usually started at this in terms of this decade and their epidemic, kind of this young adult epidemic, it has started with prescription pills. And so because prescription pills are available now as a drug of abuse for young people, it really has created just almost a slippery slope, because the prescription pill, as you and I both know, with opiates, even if someone takes them responsibly. Mm-hmm. There is a physical dependence.
Oh, yeah.
And there is a withdrawal if someone uses it for intervals over weeks of time. But so because of that powerful physical dependence that immediately happens with that, it's not necessarily that you have to have some deep psychological or emotional need, you know, to have the drug take effect or do its have its attractive effects for the user. It really is just the fear of the intense discomfort that comes with opiate withdrawal that makes things like heroin so appetizing to young people, because it's cheaper, it's a quicker high, and it's sometimes more accessible than prescription pills. When you know, mom or dad or grandpa found out that you had been stealing the medication, or you know, whatever friend who initially was just giving you a few gifts kind of cuts you off, heroin becomes the next step.
That's very sad, though. The younger generation, you know, they could do so many beautiful things and achieve a lot of things in their life, are going choosing this route.
It is very sad, you know. Being a young person, that's the healthiest decade of life.
You know, exactly. I mean, you're in the prime of your life. You can do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And so many of these young people, they're people of privilege who have so many opportunities offered to them. And to see people who have come from families where generations have gone to college, mm-hmm. you know, had very professional backgrounds, and then the next generation, you know, going in and out of rehabs or jails or all of the other kind of associated consequences of being addicted to heroin mm-hmm. come with mm-hmm. it. And unfortunately, for so many of them, and this is the saddest part of my job, you know, the death rates are just skyrocketing in this group.
Yeah, I don't understand. I mean, you know, if this is happening to affluent people, is it that is the risk factor, you think?
Well, I think a part of it is the access and the, you know, being able to afford it. You know, this is, you know, even though it's a cheaper, quicker high, if you're addicted to heroin, it can become a very expensive daily habit, $200, $300. It's not a habit, it's a disease.
Disease,
but,
yeah.
But it's, in terms of consumption, it can be, you know, hundreds of dollars, because mm-hmm. you have to constantly use more and more in order to get the same effect or to get, you know, the next desired effect. You know, after using for a prolonged period of time, heroin doesn't really make you high anymore. It just makes you less depressed. It's the nature of chronic opiate use.
Mm-hmm.
The endorphin, which makes you very happy, has a kind of counterpart called the dysnorphin. And after chronic opiate use, your body actually releases dysnorphins. And so for many of the people who come finally to see me and request detox from opiates, they say, you know, I don't even get high anymore. I just feel more like myself again,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because when they're not using, they just feel incredibly depressed.
Mm-hmm, mm. And they think that that might help, so they might go to higher doses.
Well, they have to in order to achieve the effect they're looking for.
Exactly. Yeah. You know. So what is, we were going to talk about prevention.
Yes, you know? I think the last couple times you've had me on, we've talked about the scope of this horrible problem. And, you know, because of actually a historic event this week, I wanted to talk about prevention. So the historic event that happened this week was that the American Board of Medical Specialties announced that addiction medicine is now a recognized subspecialty in medicine.
That's great.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's been, you know, hundreds of years in the making in terms of activism among patients and doctors in this field to really try to make addiction, you know, as it is a disease, recognized by entities like this. And this has many implications. First off, it means that addiction services are more likely to be covered by insurance companies. And for me, that is one of the most important things.
Very important, yeah.
Because we cannot provide good services if people cannot afford them.
Mm-hmm.
And because we are an insurance-based culture, as long as insurance companies say these are not legitimate reasons for us to cover or we don't cover, then you know, our hands are forced in terms of what we can offer.
Yeah, people also don't come to you also because they rather spend that money on the drugs, right?
It's very hard to mm-hmm. finally get to a place where you say, I'm willing to go through all this physical and emotional discomfort and finally face all these things, and then to be told, and now you have to leave because your insurance won't cover it.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. so sad. And so one of the things that happened is that in order for this to come through, the American Board of Preventive Medicine has decided that they will sponsor addiction medicine. And so that, for me, is so important because it's not just about addiction treatment. It's about prevention and treatment. And that really is what my job, for me, is about. I got into young adult and adolescent medicine because I wanted to prevent drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think one of the things that you were just alluding to about being in the prime of your life is one of the things I think is going to be the biggest key for prevention when it comes to youth and substance use. When we do not engage young minds, they make bad choices. Because by nature, the young mind is primed to take risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't give them pro-social things like athletics or theater or art, which we have been cutting mm-hmm. systematically
yep.
in mm-hmm. these same decades that we are also introducing these new medical technologies, I don't think that it's just a coincidence. It's not just the pills alone. I think a lot of these young people who have all this privilege and access are turned to drugs because they're very disconnected. And one way that they need to connect is through these activities. And then another way that they need to connect is through their families.
Mm-hmm.
And a third is through their spirituality. So I want to talk about all three today. But in terms of the first, pro-social activities, what we've talked about before with the rat experiment, you know, there's, just to remind any listener who wasn't here or heard the previous specials, you know, there was something called Rat Park. It was an experiment that was done actually in the 70s by a scientist who was trying to challenge our current notion of the addiction model in terms of animals. So the old model is you put a rat in a cage with a bar that allows the rat to hit the bar whenever they want to access basically cocaine water. So it's water with cocaine diluted in it. And what the experiment showed is if you do that, the rat will hit the bar every time, ignore food, ignore self, ignore children. And it helps us understand and define why addiction is a disease. Because if it happens in animals, it must not be a choice, which our previous mm-hmm. Listeners may not agree with. And that's another conversation for another day. But that's what we think about in medicine. And so what this scientist did is he put that same experiment where he had the rat with the cocaine water, but then he also built this amusement park as a part of the experiment that he called Rat Park. And it had wheels, and it had things that they could go in circles and mazes and all of these engaging things for a rat mind.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is not every rat chose cocaine when you put something else in. Yes, there were still some rats that hit the cocaine bar all day, but the majority of them would go and play in the park. And that is what I think is true of our youth.
It's amazing.
If we engage our youth in sports where they can take risk and get reward, you know, if we ask them to engage in the creative arts where they can, again, use that part of their brain that is the most central in adolescence, which is mm-hmm. the limbic system
mm-hmm.
and the amygdala, which is all about risk and reward. As their prefrontal cortex, that top part of their brain, is developing, as their reasoning is developing and their future orientation, all of that is developing through adolescence. So, of course, they're not thinking about that kind of stuff. They're just thinking about the immediate. And if their immediate risks are not engaging because they're essentially just video games all day long, then, yeah, opiates are going to seem really cool. So is marijuana and so is alcohol because it's something that is risky to do and it comes with a lot of dopamine reward.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing I think we can really do in terms of prevention is we can reintroduce social programming and school-based programming that allows our young people to engage their minds. School itself,
yeah,
you know, can be very engaging. Math class can mm-hmm. be protective against drug abuse mm-hmm. if it's taught the right way and mm-hmm. actually engages kids and doesn't alienate them and make them afraid. So that's one thing I think is really important in terms of prevention.
You were discussing the second thing?
The second thing is family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think one of the things we talk about a lot is the family meal and how important it is around dietary habits. But one thing that is underlooked is how protective it is against substance use. You know, kids that eat meals with their families are drastically less, and I'm sorry I don't have the actual number, I think it's something like 90% less than their peers to have substance use issues. Because that engagement, that connection, that daily face-to-face time where parents are asking questions, being involved, showing that they care,
mm-hmm.
learning about who the kid's hanging out with and what their behaviors are like, all those things that kind of just come out in family meals, or even just the act of being together as a family.
Being together. Mm-hmm.
Very protective.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that with a lot of the parents that I see, you know, some of them really don't have that connection with their kid. They want that connection with their kid. They try to substitute that connection with friendships with their kid. And that's not what these young people need. They need structure.
They need structure, yeah.
You know, unfortunately, some of these parents are doing substances with their children.
Wow.
Which is, you know, or these parents have their own substance use issues. So when the kids present with issues, they feel hesitant to talk about it because they don't want to hear the kids say, well, you're drinking all night, so what do you got a problem with me for?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that modeling that behavior within the family, showing children not just how to be pro-social in their school environments and extracurricular activities, but in the home, having the parents model pro-social behavior by being productive, healthy adults, you know, is very, very, and engaged with their children, very important. And then the third thing I think is spirituality, you know, which as a physician I think is controversial, but thankfully, you know, one of the most evidence-based programs within addiction is the AA Fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a spiritually-based program. And I'm not someone who is advertising for that fellowship or can presume to know anything about it, but there's a lot of science around it. And the science doesn't really tell us why it works, it just shows us that it works. And I think one of the big powerful things that I hear patients say about that program is it gives them a context for healing that is about spirit. And I do think that one of the, you know, and some people can argue whether or not this is spiritual. It's definitely something that's evolving as a scientific practice. Meditation is an incredibly important tool, in my opinion, to combat addiction. Because both as a preventative measure, because it helps people self-regulate and calm themselves so they don't need to use drugs to do so. And then also as a treatment measure for those very same reasons.
So how many teenagers you see, do they have any different issues with them? That's why they turn to drugs?
Well, I'll say a lot of the teenagers I see who are already addicted to drugs in their teenage years, almost all of them have very severe psychiatric illnesses or some type of psychiatric illness that goes with it. For the young adults, that's not always true. A lot of them have some anxiety and some depression, but not severe illness. For a lot of them, it really was, I was experimenting with this thing. I was being a teenager, and I was experimenting like all other generations of teenagers have done so. But the thing I was experimenting with was incredibly physically dependent. And I had these other liabilities, like I wasn't that connected to my family, or I didn't do that great in school, or I did have all this access to money, but I didn't actually see my parents because they were off vacationing a lot. You know, there's a lot of different stories I hear.
Disconnect, yeah.
There's, and for some people, yeah, my parents had dinner with me every day. They were very much in my business. But again, I was at a party, and I felt a buzz, and it felt great. And I was kind of an anxious kid already, and it felt better than anything else.
Plus, now the nowadays the teenagers are brought up like that, you know, that you are independent. You can do what you want. You don't have to answer to anybody. And I think that's wrong. If you are living in your house with your parents, I think they have a right to talk about you. You know, find out what you're doing.
Exactly.
Is it good or bad? You know, I don't understand teenagers saying, oh, you don't have any right to interfere in my, whatever he's doing, he or she is doing.
Yeah, I have to have that conversation a lot with parents where I say, you know, you say you have no control. And that is something that parents say all the time. I don't have any control. He does what he wants.
Exactly. But and you have to talk to the teenagers too. That's what I'm trying to say, because parents might try on their own, but it's the teenagers coming with that factor in their mindset.
Well, I think it has to do with the parents not setting the expectation that that is what's going to happen. You know, parents actually have a ton of control. They generally pay for everything a teenager or a young adult engages in, and sometimes a 30-year-old. It depends on the family. So having that leverage allows them to make decisions and choices that do not do not allow that type of dialogue of it's none of your business, or you know, you're not allowed to, you have to butt out, I'm an adult. These are if you're not acting like an adult because you're not paying your own bills, you're not being autonomous, you're not, you know, taking care of your own responsibilities, then I have no reason to treat you like an adult. And unfortunately, we have had a paradigm shift. You know, I think there was a lot of children are seen and not heard for a lot of time, and today's parents, a lot of them don't want to treat their children like that. And I think that's important because children do need attention, but they don't need to be the center of attention, nor do they need to be given adult rewards without actually being adults themselves.
So as far as what you're saying is there has to be a dialogue between both of them.
Yeah, I think that there definitely has to be a dialogue, but sometimes teenagers are going to be what we call pre-contemplative, mm-hmm. which means they're not going to recognize that there's a problem, and they're not going to want to work on the problem at mm-hmm. all, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. what teenager wants to be told that their freedoms are going to be limited? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. even though sometimes it's a dialogue, often it's also just the parents creating boundaries with their young people and expectations. And actually, teenagers will rebel against that in the moment, but in reality, they crave structure. And those expectations actually create a climate where they rise to the occasion.
So in your practice, when these people come, the parent and the teenager, what percentage of the people achieve this result?
Oh, I don't have a percentage for
you.
No,
I mean just a ballpark figure.
I will say that...
I mean, how many teenagers listen to what you're saying? How many parents listen to what you're saying? And they talk to each other?
I've had mixed results. Mm-hmm. I've also, you know, I also see people when things are very, very bad and they've mm-hmm. gone through a lot of other interventions. And so the people that I see might be a very skewed population in that way. Mm-hmm. But I would say, oh, you can't pin me down on a number.
No, not a number, just a ballpark figure, you know.
Like I would say it really just varies on the day and the family.
Is it a very low result or is it just average? Or?
Well, I will say the one thing about young people is their brains are plastic. That's why I like working with them. Mm-hmm. They have the ability to change actually much faster than adults. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I have families for which half of the time, you know, it might not be happening that day, but there's overall progression. Right. Mm-hmm. I have some families that make... I'd say maybe a quarter of the time, I'm getting
yeah,
rough.
Yeah, that's fine.
The kid makes a total 180 and moves in a completely different direction. Mm-hmm. And about a quarter of the time, maybe on the first visit, the kid tells me, curses at me and leaves and doesn't mm-hmm. ever come back.
Okay.
Because they don't want to hear about that.
It's a mixed result, really.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, because, you know, a lot of times people might not want to hear what you're saying. They just want to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
You know. Because basically they might think that this is the advice, and this advice is given by anybody, right?
Yeah.
So it's nothing different from anybody else.
Well, yeah, that's why when things get that bad and the young person doesn't want to listen at all, that's when I really talk to parents about what they have to leverage. Mm-hmm. Every parent has something, you know, that their kid is dependent on them for.
Exactly.
And it doesn't always have to be, you know, you have to feed your kid, but you don't have to feed your kid gourmet food.
Yeah.
They can have peanut butter and jelly 3 times a day, yeah. if that's what their behavior is eliciting.
Is there an age difference if the teenager comes at a younger age, they are much better off than the...
No, unfortunately, it's the opposite.
Oh.
So the
okay.
younger someone is when they use substances. So if you're before the age of 12, if you've used a substance, you are 4 times more likely to have a lifelong problem than if you wait until after 18.
I think that's important to let the public know, because
yes.
the younger they are, the parents should really watch over them.
Yes, I think a lot of parents say things like, oh, yeah, you know, I was a kid
easy,
and
yeah.
I did things and I turned out okay. But
exactly.
Or they look at the kid and they think, oh, that's just my little baby boy. He would never do anything.
He will never do anything, yeah.
But the bottom line is, if you are concerned that your kid is at risk for using substances or is using substances, you know, intervening sooner rather than later. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that we start having conversations with young people at age 9
wow.
around substances.
Well, time has really run out, and it always is, right?
Yes.
So thank you for coming and talking about prevention, and that's very important. If anybody wants any information, is there a website they can go to?
Sure.
Or a phone number?
My website is Whole and Healthy Youth. Whole being HOLEANDHEALTHYYOUTH.com. And my office number is 770-431-2354. And I'm accepting new patients.
Thank you very much, Dr. Saha. And I'm sure we'll want you to come back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're listening to HIT Health Issues Today. Time for me to say goodbye. Join me again next Wednesday for another edition of HIT, and stay tuned for Class Chronicles.
Thank you.